state of receptivity. You know? And this is what the chapter is to me. And what I got from it... I'll take my watch off. What I got from it was that this is a pivotal chapter, 24, because... the chapters before 20 to 23, and I've got a copy of my own notes, which I'll give you as well. Chapter 20 to 23, after the giving of the Ten Commandments, are all the laws, or a lot of the laws, laid out in those four chapters, or five chapters, for the people to take on board. Such as you shall not boil a kid in his mother's milk. The origin of kosher.
Okay?
You shall not boil a kid in his own mother's milk. Law. Well, there's five chapters of laws. Then there's chapter 24. Okay? And then there's several chapters, 25 to 31, which are all dealing with the pernickety instructions for the tabernacle. Okay? So I looked at that and I thought, what am I getting here? I'm getting before this chapter things from God. All the ideals that were mentioned earlier on, all the truths, all the highest aims possible. All the laws from God for life. Up and down, switch over to building a life for God, which is the tabernacle.
Is it that in here, because it talked about eating and drinking and they saw God, that in the sharing of their understanding and how to apply and their brotherhood, where two or three are gathered together there in the midst, is that they saw God as he actually meant to come alive in us.
Yes. Yes.
Is that's where they get it here.
Who's they?
Well, us. This expresses here where we get it.
Yeah.
And obviously representatively the people of, what is it? Aaron, Nadab, Abihu, the elders, they get it.
Mm-hmm.
And that following that, then there's instruction on how to preserve and protect that.
Yes.
Okay.
Preserve and protect.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. To actually keep it. Yes. Keep it. A couple of times in the chapter, the people... Now, where is it? Verse 7. Took the book of the covenant, read in the hearing of the people. And they said, all that the Lord has said we will do and be obedient. We will conform our state, our life, our view, ourselves. We will conform and obey that. Okay?
Unless you go out of sight for 40 days.
Unless you go out of sight for 40 days. Exactly. You see? Exactly. Good intention. Next minute.
Outside out of mind.
Next minute, what's for lunch? Yeah. In that sense. And that's the story of the children of Israel, which is our story of, which will come up tomorrow when I talk about redemption. Is it a eternally repeating process, or is it a one-off thing? Both of which I have problems with. Or is it a reoccurring process that actually gains momentum and gets somewhere in its repetition? See, forget, re-see, re-forget, re-see, re-forget, and so on. If it's not getting anywhere, take me out of existence, please, sort of thing. But if it's getting somewhere, then yes, okay. Just, is that helpful? You know, preserve and protect. I'll run through these quickly because I want to actually go into text stuff in a bit. But do come in. Exodus 24 is one of the moments of covenant between God and Israel. Covenant. The book of the covenant. Just wondering where the other word covenant comes. I thought it came more than the once.
In the blood of the covenant, wasn't it?
The blood of the covenant later on. This is the blood of the covenant. Thank you, verse 8. The blood of the covenant which the Lord has made with you according to these words. Okay, so the covenant is a reforming of the commitment between the divine and his creation. Covenant between God and Israel. And the covenant is a legal term, but it's often, perhaps nearly always, done with a handshake of some kind, where you have, in this case, the blood sprinkled on the people. In other cases, you have the rainbow. In other cases, it was a beautiful rainbow last night, by the way. Wow, did anyone see it?
No.
Oh, yeah, I did. It was the double rainbow.
Oh,
right.
Yeah,
I
think
it was just glorious. And I thought, yeah, that bodes well for the seminar. So the rainbow, the blood, the seeing the myriad of stars with Abraham and so on. These covenants are reforging the relationship between God and the children of Israel. And, again, it's this preserve and protect. You know, I guess we've all had experience of, in some way, moments where we've perhaps not understood fully, but we know it's the way to go. And we say, don't know if you even exist, God, but I'm
here.
With
he is,
you.
He's coming.
Is there a sign?
Sign and a representation.
At least it's not the milk truck, holy cow.
That goes just as fast as Mr. Whippy. How you pour a coffee in that spoon?
I hope there's a bloke doing it and it's not just electronic. Don't go there,
please.
So covenanting, boy is big. Okay? It's actually you and God reforming that precious, deep connection.
In the sacramental service too.
Yes.
Covenant in my blood.
Yes, this is the new covenant in my blood. And we shouldn't gloss over covenant too quickly because it's the rededication both ways, dead serious and for real and so on in that sense. From us too, you know? You know, and when you take any vow, when you make any promise, what was it, David? The four Toltec agreements? Be impeccable in your word. You know? Do not say things lightly when they mean so much. You know? If you're gonna follow God, don't just follow him if the month has an R in it.
More so like with what defiles you is what can come out of your mouth than rather what you put into your mouth.
Yes, yes, nice one. Yes, yes indeed. And the last word in the example list that Jesus gives, you know, blasphemy, fornication, licentiousness, you know, whoa. Do I do that? Yes, you do, Julie. But the last one is the telling one, that's foolishness. You know? If you won't relate to any of the others, foolishness, that's below the belt.
What about forgetfulness? Is that in here? That one you can say, yeah, no, I do everything right.
Well, it's not in the list.
It's not in the list.
Caroline?
Well, I was just going to say the least... reciprocal nature of it seems to be that legal handshake, as you said, of the covenant, and that it requires permission in a way to be able to do it, because he didn't lay his hand on the nobles, you know, who just ate and drank. So it's also don't know what I'm trying to get at, really, that it's only available, I suppose, within, as you said earlier, what you're willing to take on in our journey.
Yes.
So it's only provided once you've given so much yourself.
It's always a two-way street.
Meetings.
Yes. Yeah. But that means the higher nature. But it's not just that God giving something, it's that we have to actually accept it, and we have to be acceptable as well.
Yes, we have to make ourselves be acceptable, not by what we do, because that's opprobrium, but by who we are. And that enables us to be receptive, and we then have to make an action of response to what God offers us in terms of contract. So there's three themes. There's God's offer, there's our clearing and making ourselves worthy in a being sense rather than a doing sense, and there is the actual response that we're to make. And I will stick my neck out here and say that in the Bible, for anything to happen that is constructive, there must be a God-given and a response offered back. You know? I think about the miracles of Jesus, for example. Jesus nearly always got a verbal answer or an action or a faith or a pleading or whatever from the person to actually be able to do the miracle, and then said, your faith in me is what has healed you. You see? Always this up and down. Okay, well, we've covered quite a bit of my seven things, which is probably good. Moses is told to go up the mountain 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 1, 9, 12, 13, and 15. For us, up is our ability to sense life in terms of God's greater purpose, which cuts through the appearances of normal time and space living. Those are illusory, but upness is being able to see more accurately the true nature of our existence. And Moses is told to go up the mountain repeatedly, and in fact at one point very strangely then Moses nine, then Moses went up and they saw the God of Israel, so they saw God and they ate and drank. Then the Lord said to Moses, come up to me on the mountain and be there. Hang on, I'm here, you know. There's sort of this up, I don't want to go into sort of up above up. That's sort of a bit silly in a way. But it's the perfect way in which the crafting of the text is, you know, emphasising come up, and so on. Even when the sort of appearance of the text is, we're already up. And notice the variety of the types of people that come. First of all is Aaron, Nadab, Abihu. And then the next one in verse 13 is Joshua and Joshua. Moses went up the mountain of God. And in the next verse, he said to the elders, wait here for us, the elders who'd gone up previously, wait here for us until we come back to you. Indeed, Aaron and Hur, Aaron had gone up before, but now, no. If any man has a difficulty, let him go to them. And I sort of look at that, and my own sort of creative spirituality says, Aaron's already been up the mountain, therefore if he's at some aspect of my life which is now equipped, he can actually be an intermediary for the people. So he can stay down here now and help the people who are down at the foot of the mountain and able to see the mountain but not allowed to go up the mountain.
Julian, it strikes me as no coincidence that there's a symmetry about this chapter, which is from 1 to 8, there is instruction, a command, and a preparation.
Yep.
From 9 onwards, it's him actually doing stuff and going up. And it's almost like 9 is a repeat of 1. Sorry.
No,
I'm finished. Yeah.
If I can take you back to that idea of covenant, Julian, my understanding is that the covenant with God is everlasting, is eternal, whereas the children of Israel at various times were able to break the covenant and they just turned away completely from the covenant and did their own thing. But God didn't cancel his side. They got punished, got dealt with.
Consequences,
but the covenant remained there from God. For his part, he was unchanged.
Yes,
and it applies all the way through to us and beyond forever.
Mm-hmm. So, from God's covenanting, it's eternal, unchanging, never wavering according to our response. The sun shines on the just and the unjust.
It's never withdrawn because we do the wrong thing.
No. It's not capricious. Mm-hmm. It's not. It's there, yeah. And we, you know, we ebb and flow positively. Okay, and that's another thing. You know, we tend to look at see it, lose it, or do it wrong, we tend to see that as, we're very quick to start loathing ourselves in that sense, to put ourselves down. And I think to actually turn this into a productive, a progressive thing where even the very fact of forgetting it, what Kim said, forgetting it, mistaking it, getting it wrong and so on, is actually a very positive cycle of experience in our existence, so that we actually keep re-getting it better than before, you know, in that sense. Okay. A couple more things. The site of the mountain near the end of the chapter. Now, 15. Then Moses went up into the mountain and a cloud covered the mountain. Okay? The cloud is the veiling, but also the glory. Every cloud has a silver lining. The veiling and the glory of that mysterious high truth. Okay? And Moses goes up into the mountain, and a cloud covered the mountain. Now the glory of the Lord rested on Mount Sinai, and a cloud covered it 6 days. And on the seventh day, he called to Moses out of the midst of the cloud. The sight of the glory of the Lord was like a consuming fire on the top of the mountain in the eyes of the children of Israel.
All right.
Okay? You get the picture, I'm sure. You know, thunder and lightnings, perhaps, but light and this cloud on the mountain. And I think that's fabulous, because that is a physical world feature. Okay? It's a physical world feature where mountains are cloud covered and the sun shines gloriously around and underneath the cloud, if I can put it like that. So it's a very archetypal image of what the children of Israel are able to see, which is not God directly, but actually God up in cloud, obscurity, veiled, can't understand this, and the inner glory, which is perceived within it, but, you know, again, not fully. And it's like a consuming fire on the top of the mountain in the eyes of the children of Israel. And again, you know, it's this idea, it's getting ever so hot in here, unless it's me raising the kilowatts.
Maybe we should open some windows.
Can we open some windows? Or...
I think it's too much trouble to do.
You just want the air blind without getting cold.
Okay.
You've tripled the amount of cool air coming in there.
This idea of, you know, we'd be zapped. We'd be zapped if we saw too much. Okay? So the Lord must accommodate, sweet little word, atmosphereize and give physical atmosphere, filtering out the sun. The Lord must guard us with appearances so that we are not, that are revelatory enough to give us the glory within the cloud, but are not full-blown, you know, too much too soon zappers.
The same thing happened at Solomon's temple. It was filled with cloud.
Yes. Yeah, the temple was filled with cloud. So, yes. Yes.
Yeah, true. But as you sort of observed that, it's not actually until verse 12... that it specifically says that they're going up on the mountain,
yep,
or up into the mountain. I don't know if there's any significance there. They talk about going up, but it's not until 12 that specifically starts to go up on the mountain.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Mm. Yeah.
Good point.
But what does one say then?
Sorry?
What's the difference between 12 and 1?
Well, the mountain.
It's just telling
come up,
to go
come up.
Come up.
Come up to the Lord, and 12 is come up on the mountain.
And 10, what, God was in front of them down at the bottom of the mountain, is that right?
No.
Maybe they were halfway up.
Nine, then Moses, this is, you know, this is escalators in the department store, you know, what level are we on?
Well, I think Joe, if he was referring to the Enneagram, I don't know, but 1 to 9 to 9.
Then Moses went up, also Aaron and the others, and they saw the God of Israel. And there was under his feet, under God's feet, pavements of sapphire stone.
So God just keeps up.
Yes. God is up, but God is also standing on and being on a pavement of precious stone, which is the way in which the divine touches the very substance of life, which is our path and journey, which is sapphire. When it becomes sapphire, I'm going fanciful now, but it becomes sapphirical, sapphirical, when the divine is in our walking. So the pavement is not concrete, it's sapphire.
Yeah, when we're on the right path.
When we're on the right path and it's glorious.
Even at the lowest appreciation of God, it still transforms.
Yes. God stands on a pavement.
Yes.
All
right, well, with all that wisdom, what would you say to someone that said,
did Moses exist?
Did the mountain exist?
I've got a few frogs in my throat.
Someone that's not Christian, and someone says, look, that's very good, but this is far too sophisticated for a people 3,000-4,000 years ago to have put together as a piece of psychology, which you've explained very well, and it all fits together, but it's all too sophisticated, you've made it up to fit. How would you answer someone that says something like that? Because it is beautiful, we're inclined to believe. What if someone else that is just sitting there mutually, and you presented that, said, that's great, it hangs together, but it's too sophisticated, so I don't believe it.
Part of me would say, that's your problem. Okay.
The truth is veiled in a cloud.
Yeah. Part of me would say the people 3,000 or 4,000 years ago were probably differently but equally receptive of enlightenment and meaning. My back, Joe.
He's backing you.
But you know, you go to the pyramids. I'd ask them to go and look at the pyramids and say, look at those pyramids, do some research, Google it, and tell me if this pyramidology is actually is primitive. Because it blooming well isn't. And I think the receptiveness of the human mind changes but does not lessen or grow at times. It just becomes a different receptivity. And one day look at the constructions in sacred architecture going way back. And you will see the incredible non-committee decided, instant, full, collective constructions that people brought into being, and so on. So
that's very good. That's a very good answer.
Can I have another go at a different approach to that? Sorry, do you want to?
Go for it, Joe.
I would have the tendency to say, based on my experience in looking into a lot of things different ways, from a scientific perspective, from a non-Christian perspective, I've been through that too, is that, in my view, if something doesn't make sense, full sense, complete sense, and it's inner integrity, and it's been held up in such high regard for so long, there has to be another explanation, a deeper or some other explanation. I'd go looking for that. And it seems to me that only when I came across this coherence between all the symbolism of these concepts and words and how they are used and what they represent, when you look at it from that point of view, everything makes sense in a nice, coherent pattern way that I can't dismiss. My scientific mind can't dismiss that and go, oh yeah, that's just pure coincidence because there's too many of them. That's my approach to that, but and that's quite a different answer to Julian's. But take that on board, maybe, or argue with me, and then I can learn.
Because it has a structure when explained like that. That does have the integrity, and that's very difficult to do without someone over the last 3,000 years. Got you on clause 7, word 3. Yeah, it doesn't, and no one said that. Once Sweden will reveal it, and it does hang together so miraculously well.